Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who's Wise made for? It's made for jet setters and slow travelers, for online marketplaces and real-life bazaars, for business in the city and pleasure on the coast. Wise is made for studying abroad and supporting your little brother's schooling back home. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
After the U.S. led the invasion of Iraq, there was concern about the future. Now, 20 years later, many young Iraqis say they're again worried about the future. Our leaders only care about power, this 20-year-old in Baghdad tells us. Also today, UN climate scientists send out an urgent warning.
Humanity is on thin ice, and that ice is melting fast. Our world needs climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once.
I'm Marco Werman. There's also anxiety around the health of the global economy, but compared to the 2008 financial crisis, something is different.
This time round, banks are not the cause of the recession.
All that and more today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 20 years ago today, 2003, the U.S. launched an invasion of Iraq. Even before the air assault began and ground forces were moving over the border, American leaders had for months been saying that Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was a threat.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror.
That was more than a year earlier in January 2002. George W. Bush used his State of the Union address to name Iraq, alongside Iran and North Korea, as part of a, quote, axis of evil.
The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade.
Bush administration officials spoke continuously about Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and weapons of mass destruction during the summer and fall of 2002. Then in February 2003, Secretary of State Colin Powell made the hard sell at the United Nations Security Council.
The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
Despite the pressure from the White House, the Security Council did not authorize the use of military force. Still, the U.S. led a coalition of the willing into battle in March of 2003. Around 160,000 troops during the initial invasion, about three-quarters of them American, most of the others British. Later that year in mid-December, Saddam Hussein was captured. No weapons of mass destruction were ever found. What followed was years of insurgency, military occupation, and sectarian violence. Nearly 5,000 American troops died in Iraq. The toll paid by the Iraqi people is much heavier and also harder to measure. Today we examine the impact of the invasion on the lives of young Iraqis who've grown up in its aftermath. From Baghdad, the world's Shirin Jafari has our story.
Today is Muhammad Hashim Kazem's birthday. He's a university student in Baghdad. Back in 2003, his mother planned to deliver him at the hospital. But when she went into labor on March 20th, American jets were bombing the city. She couldn't make it to the hospital, he says. She was too scared they might get hit on the way. Her only option was to go to the home of a neighbor who had some experience delivering babies. The years of war in Iraq have touched everyone's lives here. But for younger Iraqis like Kazem, it's the only reality they've ever known. Iraqis born after the year 2000 make up about half the population. Kazem's first memory of the war goes back to when he was about 3 years old. He was standing outside his parents' house in Baghdad when a military vehicle pulled up. An American soldier stepped out. Kazem says he was shocked because the soldier was a woman, but her uniform, her gun, and the vehicle It all reminded him of what he had seen in the movies. Kadhim tells me he feels conflicted about the U.S.-led invasion. On the one hand, he's happy he doesn't live under a dictatorship. But at the same time, he says he can't wrap his head around all the atrocities that the invasion unleashed. What pains him more, he says, is that after all the sacrifices and deaths, Iraq is not in a good place today. Our leaders only care about power, he says. As long as there is ignorance, I don't see a future for this country. Since 2005, Iraq has held 6 parliamentary elections, but corruption and political dysfunction continue to plague this country. Last year, reports surfaced about a $2.5 billion tax embezzlement. It was described here as the theft of the century. Iraq is listed by Transparency International as one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. The sun is about to set in Baghdad. In a busy street, there's a store that sells natural hair products. 23-year-old Nada Al-Qureshi works as a cashier here. Qureshi, who grew up in this city, remembers the sounds of jets and the bombs during the U.S.-led invasion. She says she spent hours inside the bomb shelter with her cousins who lived on the same street. As the violence continued, she says her parents forbid her from going outside, so home started to feel like a prison. Tragedy hit her family when one of her cousins was killed by a rocket that struck his home. Qureshi says as a child, she didn't understand why the Americans were in her city, why there was so much violence. Eventually, she was able to go to school again. And today, Qureshi studies law. She hopes to become a judge one day. But she says Iraq is full of unknowns. Even for educated people like us, there is no guarantee we will find a job after graduation, she says. In the years following 2003, about 200,000 Iraqi civilians were killed. That's according to Brown University's Cost of War project. Many lives were cut short.
Sabah, Usaja, Ali, Haida, Sajjad, Unaha.
Leila Hossein Wali lost all 6 of her children in an airstrike on April 6, 2003. She names them one by one. Wali was with a large group of her relatives fleeing the bombings in Baghdad. They went to an area north of the city and took shelter near an open airfield, she says. That's where they were hit by an airstrike. Everyone died except for Wali and 4 other women. Her youngest child was 8 months old. She was breastfeeding him. I wish I had died too, she tells me. I have died 1,000 times in the past 20 years. Every year when school reopens, when college graduations take place, they remind me of my children. I ask her what she wants to tell Americans on this 20th anniversary. What can I say, she asks. We were just sitting there after evacuating our homes. We didn't harm anyone. Don't they have children or families too? The invasion of Iraq and its aftermath continue to impact everyone's lives here. There are physical reminders of the war too. In Baghdad today, concrete blast walls are still in place. Armored SUVs cruise the streets. And 2,500 U.S. troops are based in the country. Even if most Americans have moved on from the Iraq war, for Iraqis, it's part of their past, present, and future. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Baghdad, Iraq.
If anybody thought that the International Criminal Court's warrant for Vladimir Putin's arrest would have the Russian president laying low, they would be wrong. Over the weekend, Putin made a surprise visit to Russian-occupied Ukraine with a late-night tour in the bombed-out city of Mariupol. He then flew back to Moscow, where earlier today he welcomed China's leader Xi Jinping at the airport. She is the highest-profile leader to visit Moscow since Russia invaded Ukraine more than a year ago. The World's Daniel Hoffman has this report on the significance of the summit at this moment in the war.
One of the last times that Putin and Xi met in person was in February of last year in China, just before the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics.
Two presidents who want the world to know that they are on the same page. Today, the leaders of China and Russia promised each other deeper ties with, quote, no limits.
A no-limit partnership. That phrase grabbed the attention of many across the globe. A few weeks later, after the conclusion of the Olympic Games, Russia invaded Ukraine.
Vladimir Putin's trip to China on the eve of the invasion of Ukraine put China in a very difficult position because it raised suspicions that the Chinese enabled the Russian war.
That's Joseph Tarigian. He's a professor at the School of International Service at American University. He says it's unclear whether Russia warned China that it would invade Ukraine. However, once the invasion occurred, China tried to present itself as a neutral actor.
Chinese have definitely given significant support to the Russians, but at the same time, they've been cautious in the sense that they're afraid of reputational and economic costs if they are seen as helping the Russians too much.
China has presented itself as a diplomatic leader that could mediate future negotiations, even though China and Russia have long been strategic partners.
That strategic partnership was the result of economic complementarities, including Russia's sale of oil and gas and China's sale of consumer goods and technology to Russia. But also they had very similar views about the world.
Tarigian says that both countries are aligned in their view that the U.S. is an adversary. But from Russia's perspective, the clash with the West is playing out in real time on the battlefield in Ukraine.
Russia now views its relationship with the rest of the world almost entirely through the prism of the war against Ukraine. And that means Russia understands that its relationship with the West is not going to improve anytime soon, and that it needs all the help that it can get.
And Russia is getting some help from China, as the two countries have increased bilateral trade over the last year. But Russia would also like to get weapons from China, something that Tarigian says isn't likely to happen anytime soon.
There are a lot of reasons for the Chinese not to sell weapons. They would face sanctions. They would face reputational costs. It would create a sense in the West that China and Russia really are a bloc. So for China to make that decision, it would be a real watershed moment.
In recent months, the U.S. warned China that supporting Russia's war effort in Ukraine would come with consequences. Here's Timur Umarov. He's a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I don't think that there is a high possibility of China transforming from a neutral country into a supporter of Russia's aggression here. China would risk escalating its own relationship with the U.S.
But that doesn't mean that China will be pushing for peace.
The scenario where this conflict becomes a frozen conflict for years would be something that China would be okay with, because China not only gets the weak and isolated Russia, but also has the U.S. distracted from relationship with China.
Umarov says that China will wait and see how things play out on the battlefield and will not overcommit in either direction. From Russia's perspective, though, Xi's visit to Moscow is a big deal.
For Russia, the fact that Xi Jinping came to Moscow is already a big win in this situation.
And Umarov says it's a big win even if China doesn't change its stance on military support. Russia can show that despite the sanctions,
Putin is not isolated, that China didn't turn its back on Putin. And although China doesn't support Russia on every single question regarding the war in Ukraine, there are still some questions that they found themselves on the same page.
And less than a week after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin, a high-profile meeting in Moscow with Xi will be seen in some places as a major boost to the Russian president's reputation. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
It started more than a week ago with Silicon Valley Bank, and this weekend Credit Suisse was the casualty. We'll look at the worries that continue to stir global banking next. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. This weekend, the demise of Credit Suisse became clear as another bank, UBS, moved to take it over with the help of regulators. This is the latest turn in a long week of global financial concern over banks, nerves that started with Silicon Valley Bank in California 2 weeks ago. Julian Wellesley is here to help us understand the Credit Suisse story. He's a global bank analyst at Loomis Sayles & Company and used to be a managing director at UBS, so he's got a lot of insight into the financial turmoil playing out in Switzerland. To get to today's news, Julian, I want to understand, first of all, who are these two players, UBS and Credit Suisse, and what happened exactly at Credit Suisse?
So UBS and Credit Suisse are the two largest banks in Switzerland. They're both historic institutions, and they're both in the top 30 banks in the world in terms of their importance to the global financial system. And they've always been arch rivals, like the Red Sox and the Yankees. What happened over this weekend was that UBS bought Credit Suisse in a rescue acquisition that was coordinated by the Swiss regulator.
Those stats are pretty remarkable. When you look at what happened with Credit Suisse, this muscular bank, where did it all start and when did things start to go wrong?
Well, Credit Suisse has had problems that have been well known for some time. The share price has been down about 90% in the last 10 years, and Credit Suisse has been criticized by the regulators for having poor risk controls and weak financial reporting.
So when banking information was leaked about Credit Suisse's clients, some of whom were dictators, torturers, criminals, this came through the so-called Swiss leaks. Did that play a role in their eventual demise?
I don't think so. Swiss banks have historically been a place to hide money, whether that's from undemocratic governments or from the spouse that you're divorcing or from tax authorities. But having said that, Swiss banking secrecy has been substantially rolled back over the last 10 years. I think the causes are actually in the global financial crisis of 15 years ago. In that crisis, UBS had to be rescued and was partially nationalized by the Swiss government. And Credit Suisse was fine. So the tables have now turned because it's UBS that's taking over Credit Suisse. And I think because UBS was partially owned by the Swiss government, the government put a lot of constraints on how UBS could operate. It shrunk its investment bank and was in much better health over the last decade than Credit Suisse has been.
So let me get back to this point you just made. Kind of an irony, the fact that UBS was bailed out in the 2008 financial crisis and now they're doing the bailing. Did their failure back in 2008 somehow help them later on, like today?
Yes, it did. The Swiss regulator was strict about the kind of activities that it could do. It encouraged UBS to shrink the investment bank, and that put it in a much stronger position today that enabled it to take over Credit Suisse.
I mean, now that UBS has taken over Credit Suisse, is the story over? I mean, at least in this cycle of concern, has the last domino fallen?
I think from the point of Swiss banks, this should go a long way to calming investor nerves.
Taking on Credit Suisse, it seems like a massive consolidation of banking inside Switzerland. What risk does that new size create? Is Switzerland good with that?
I think Swiss regulators will be pleased to see that risks around Credit Suisse will be substantially reduced under the ownership of UBS. Regulators may be concerned about the combined size of the two banks, which are about twice the size of the Swiss economy. And so we may see UBS reducing its exposure via sale or shutting down parts of the business.
Julian Wellesley is a global bank analyst at Loomis Sayles & Company and is an expert on banking in Switzerland, having worked previously at UBS. Julian, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at how deep the so-called contagion is in global banking. In Uganda, Parliament is on track to pass an anti-homosexuality bill. Civil rights activists are calling it hate legislation. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our report and a quick word of warning. This story may not be appropriate for all listeners.
When MP Asuman Basilirwa introduced the bill on the Parliament floor, he called homosexuality a cancer.
Across the country, there is an outcry of homosexual-related issues, promotion in schools, and there is a public concern.
Gay sex is already illegal in Uganda, but this new bill would go even further. identifying as gay or trans would be a crime. Touching somebody with the intention, in quotes, of having gay sex with them would be a crime. And then there's a clause about promoting homosexuality. Somebody who's accused of doing that could be imprisoned for up to 5 years. Oriya Mnyeha is the Uganda researcher for Human Rights Watch.
Promoting homosexuality stems from this idea, this misconception that's been intentionally spread, that homosexuality is something foreign. It's something that this murky, shadowy group of people brought and they are trying to recruit our children into.
That idea is echoed in the media.
There is a growing concern from a cross-section of Ugandans that activities of homosexuality are penetrating the country, especially among the youth in schools.
By religious leaders.
But when your children are being sodomized, and you are quiet, don't be silent.
And by people at the highest level of government who are trying to get the anti-homosexuality bill passed. This bill is very much a redo of the original Anti-Homosexuality Act Parliament passed back in 2013. It was signed into law by President Yoweri Museveni in an elaborate signing ceremony at his official residence.
Even now, I have not really fully understood it, that you can fail to be attracted to all these beautiful women here, and you are attracted by a man. It means there's something really wrong with you.
Western countries and donors condemned that law, and they withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Uganda. In 2014, the law was repealed, thrown out by a judge over a technicality. Nicholas Opio was the lead lawyer prosecuting that case. He says politicians tried to reintroduce the law immediately, but those attempts failed.
The atmosphere at the time, at least internationally, was that there were so many voices from all over the world condemning Uganda. The president in Uganda didn't want to get into that sort of argument at the time.
But now, 10 years later, it's a different story, he says.
I don't see the same level of condemnation, the same level of advocacy around this law in the foreign capitals. We have been trying to push governments around the world, in Europe, in the US, in the Scandinavian region, to speak out. Nobody has spoken out. The bill is being fast-tracked in parliament.
Civil rights activists say if this bill becomes law, there will be even more violence and harassment against the gay community in Uganda. And things are already pretty bad, says Frank Mugisha, a gay rights activist in the capital, Kampala.
We are seeing increased violence towards the LGBTQ community. We are seeing a lot of hatred. This time we are seeing the hatred coming from ordinary Ugandans.
Mugisha says attacks have happened at private events, parties, and soccer games. Last month, three trans women were arrested at their homes in Kampala and charged with committing unnatural offenses and subjected to anal exams. 2 weeks ago, a teacher at a girls' school in Jinja was arrested for promoting homosexuality at the school amid rumors she was a lesbian. Hundreds of parents stormed the school, threatening to pull out their children. All this around the same time the anti-homosexuality bill was introduced in the parliament. The bill now has a very brief public hearing period. After that, it goes back to the parliament, where it's expected to pass. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
It is The World. After weeks of refusing to budge, Israel's prime minister is backing away from parts of a controversial plan to remake the judiciary. So far, though, the opposition does not seem impressed, and the political divide is as stark as ever.
Israel feels like it's just coming apart at the seams.
The fight for democracy in Israel still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Consider it a final warning of sorts. The highest-profile group of climate scientists in the world says that time is running out to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Humanity is on thin ice, and that ice is melting fast. Our world needs climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once.
That was the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres commenting on the report put out by the United Nations Science Panel and not letting a cultural movie moment go to waste. Join me now for more on this is the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. It was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, that released this new report today, Carolyn. What stands out to you?
My takeaway is that the science on what needs to be done to limit global warming has not changed. Deep, immediate cuts to greenhouse gas emissions. But the amount of time that there's left to do it just keeps shrinking and shrinking.
Right. Give us an example of how the report, this report, communicates that.
So the report released today was a synthesis report, which means it sums up all the science from six different reports that the IPCC has put together since 2018 with the idea of guiding policymakers at UN climate talks. Back in 2018, they published an analysis of what it would take to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That is the strictest target that world leaders agreed to try to hit in the Paris Climate Agreement. What they found was that the world would have to slash emissions by 45% by 2030 to keep that target in reach. Now, 2030 is just 7 years away, and emissions have actually continued to increase each year rather than go down. So the window is shrinking.
I shudder to even ask, is the goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius even realistic anymore?
It has always been a stretch goal, if you want to put it like that, and now it's even more so. Today at a press conference, one of this report's authors, Peter Thorne, said the world is likely to hit that 1.5 degrees of warming early in the 2030s.
The real question is whether our will to reduce emissions quickly means we reach 1.5 degrees, but then come back down, or whether we go blasting through 1.5 degrees, go through even 2 degrees and keep on going. So the future really is in our hands. The rest of this decade is key.
Key to limiting just how hot heat waves get, how intense hurricanes grow, how long droughts stretch, how much of our coasts are obliterated by rising seas, etc., etc.
Scientists have been framing this as a race against time for a while. Why is this the IPCC's last big warning?
This science panel will not publish more climate reports for another 5 to 7 years, so this is probably their last chance to really take this message to policymakers before the globe passes this critical 1.5 degree target.
Also, when it comes to UN climate talks, I understand there's a matter of timing.
That's right. This fall, world leaders will meet in Dubai for their next UN climate summit. They'll start the process of setting new carbon-cutting targets for the year 2035. The report published today will provide the scientific basis for those discussions. And in an effort to be relevant to those discussions, the authors calculated and published a new target for a global emissions reduction of 60% by 2035. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who we heard from earlier, was even more concrete. He called on rich countries specifically to stop using coal, oil, and natural gas by 2040.
I mean, as Peter Thorne said earlier, the future is in our hands. What else stood out to you about this latest report, Carolyn?
In this last cycle of reports from the IPCC, there's been more of a focus on the human impacts of climate change and on the need for adaptation. The authors also really stress that the solutions to cut carbon emissions already exist. That's something that Lily Fua from the Center for International Environmental Law picked up on as she was observing the negotiations over this report this past week.
What's become even clearer is that the solutions are readily available and proven to work. So we don't only know more about the crisis, the causes, and the impacts. We also know much more about the solutions that work.
Are we talking about solutions on a system-wide level here or in terms of what individuals can do?
Both. The biggest thing that needs to happen is that the world needs to move away from burning fossil fuels very quickly. So that requires huge changes to the way our energy systems work. But recent reports from the IPCC actually also have highlighted that action at every level is necessary. Report author Peter Thorne put it in context this way today.
We are beyond the point where climate change can be somebody else's problem. If we had had the foresight to act in 1990, we would have a vast vista of options available to us. The reality is we, at all levels, governments, communities, individuals, have made climate change somebody else's problem. We have to stop that. We have to act now. Do not say it is your government's problem.
Again, you hear this idea that the action that needs to be taken has not changed. The amount of time that we have to take it has.
The World's Environment Correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Today's IPCC report finds that if global warming shoots past 1.5 degrees Celsius, some impacts will be irreversible. That may include in coastal regions impacted by sea level rise and areas downstream from melting mountain glaciers. In the Andes and the Himalayas, the water from glaciers feed lakes that are expanding dramatically and are now a threat to millions of people. In Peru, there's one lake fed by a glacier that is now 30 times larger than it was in 1970. Reporter Manuel Rueda went there to find out how people are adapting.
The turquoise waters of Lake Balcacocha are a beautiful sight to behold. The lake is located almost 15,000 feet above sea level in the Andes Mountains, and on one of its edges you can see a huge glacier looming above the water, its white cliffs sparkling under the sun. But as temperatures here become warmer and melt ice sheets, this charming lake has become increasingly dangerous, says Jesus Gomez, an expert on glaciers at Peru's Institute for the Study of Mountainous Ecosystems.
Si cae un pedazo de bloques de hielo de gran tamaño o magnitud,
if a large chunk of ice breaks off from the glacier and falls into the lake, it will empty the lake out and generate floods and avalanches downstream, he says. The avalanche could easily reach Juarez, a city of 100,000 people in a valley below. Here, several neighborhoods have been built along a river that comes from Lake Balcacocha. Deo Pineda lives in a three-story house by the river. This melting of the glaciers is already making the levels of the river go up, he says. So we're worried about what could happen. Juarez isn't the only mountain town that's threatened by an overflowing lake. According to a study published in February by the Nature Communications Journal, 15 million people around the world are currently exposed to these kinds of floods. Scientists call them glacier lake outbursts. Elsewhere in Peru, the district of Carhuaz was flooded in 2010, when chunks of ice broke off a glacier and fell into a lake below.
Que tenía un dique de 23 metros. Cae toda la masa de hielo.
That lake was fenced off by a 23-meter-tall dike, says Gomez, the glacier expert. But the waves generated by the fallen ice were so large they surpassed it. Juarez was itself devastated by floods in 1941, when Lake Balcacocha burst, as scientists say, and sent an avalanche of mud and water downstream. Around 10 million cubic liters spilled out of the lake and into the city, after heavy rains eroded the land around Balcacocha.
It's probably the largest volume of water ever to impact a major urban settlement, I think, in the world.
Archaeologist Stephen Wagner wrote a book about that flood. He says it killed 1,800 people.
That large volume of water came down very abruptly and impacted the more modern urban expansion part of the city of Juarez. It tumbled boulders that could be two stories high. Granite boulders were rolled along. It said it made an infernal sound, this grinding and rumbling.
To stop the lake from bursting again, officials in Juarez have built a dike on its southwest edge, where water flows out of the lake. They've also set up big plastic tubes that siphon water out of the lake so that its levels don't rise. Marlene Rosario is overseeing these projects, which are financed by the regional government. The problem with just siphoning water out of the lake is that we're not preserving the water for future use, she says. The city has plenty of water now, but if the glacier continues to retreat, that water could become polluted, because it will come into contact with toxic minerals.
Porque lo ideal es tener sistemas que regulen y guarden el agua que se produce en esa quebrada.
Eventually, we'll need to build reservoirs and treatment plants below the lake, Rosario says. Some residents want those who are responsible for climate change to help pay for these adaptations. In 2017, mountaineering guide Saul Julia teamed up with German Watch, an environmental group. They're suing German power company RWE.
El glaciar cada vez es menos. Las industrias.
I've seen firsthand how the glaciers are melting because of climate change, Yuya says, and we need to make companies who are responsible for that accountable. RWE made electricity for decades in Europe by burning massive amounts of coal, and some studies claim that the power company is responsible for 0.5% of global emissions since the 19th century. So Yuya's lawsuit says RWE should pay for 0.5% of the cost of flood prevention programs in Juarez, or around $20,000. It's currently being reviewed by a German court.
Si demandamos, si presionamos, van a cambiar su modelo de producción.
We put some pressure on those who emit greenhouse gases. Perhaps they'll have to change their practices, Yuya says. We're not going to recover all the damage that's been done, but at least we can stop this kind of pollution in the future. Lake Palcacocha has long been a source of water for Huaraz and the surrounding villages. People here are hoping that with the right adaptations, it will no longer be a threat to the city's survival. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Huaraz, Peru.
The French government survived two votes of no confidence today. The roll calls in the French parliament came just days after the prime minister forced through the hugely unpopular proposal of her boss, President Emmanuel Macron, to raise the retirement age in France from 62 to 64. Protests in several cities across France have continued for the last 3 days. A major strike action is planned for Thursday, with trade unions saying they are not going to back down. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joins us for the latest. Explain to us what happened this evening, Orla.
Well, there were two votes of no confidence, as you said, following this really unpopular decision to force through the pension reform bill. One of the confidence votes this evening came from Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party. That failed. The second came from a centrist group of opposition lawmakers. And this was the one that Macron's government was most worried about, because Macron's party doesn't hold an absolute majority in Parliament. And they worried about the number of lawmakers from the centre-right, the Les Républicains party, that might vote for it. They needed today 287 votes for a no-confidence motion to succeed. They got 278, so they were just 9 votes short, and there was a bit of a gasp in the chamber in the National Assembly when the vote was called out this evening. MPs from Macron's own party have been saying just a short time ago that they didn't expect that it would be this close. One of the opposition MPs is saying that they see it practically as a victory for them because the numbers are so high. The last time, Marco, by the way, that a prime minister was brought down under a no confidence motion in France was back in 1962. That was Georges Pompidou under Charles de Gaulle. So it would have been, you know, seen as almost unprecedented if that had happened. I should say the position of the Prime Minister, Elizabeth Borne, may not be secure. You know, she won the vote this evening, but barely. And many say that her position continues to be untenable and that she has lost a lot of credibility over forcing this vote through in the first place. The opposition are saying that they're going to continue to fight the pension reform bill, that they're talking about bringing it to the Constitutional Council. There's talk about calling for a referendum on the issue. So it's not yet clear that the pension reform will go through, but for the moment, Macron's government is safe.
I gather there's another huge day of strike action planned for this Thursday. What's the mood like in France at the moment?
That's right. In fact, in Paris, there's a huge police presence in Paris at the moment. Protesters are chanting, Macron should be dismissed, Macron resign. But there were strikes again in parts of France today. The city of Rennes, for example, saw huge disruption because workers had blocked some of the main roads into the city. There was bins set on fire in Nantes. The garbage strike that you spoke about last week, that's still underway in the capital. Lawmakers within Macron's own party, they've had their offices attacked in parts of France over the last couple of days, and some of them have additional security details now because they fear that they may be attacked. But people are very angry. There was a survey out just this morning saying almost 2/3 of the French support the strikes and the blocking of certain sectors like oil refineries and transport and waste collection. And that figure is up 4 points on last week. So it seems that this forcing through of the pension reform bill, this using of the 49.3 article, it's added fuel to the fire. I was talking to Resine Weber in Paris earlier. She's a fellow with the German Marshall Fund there. And she was saying, you know, Macron appears to have underestimated the strength of the public feeling over this. But this kind of anger didn't just erupt in the last few weeks.
I think it is important to understand, for instance, the Yellow Vest movement never really went away. It faded in late 2019, but then there was COVID and it was quite difficult for them to continue. But the underlying causes, all these issues, for example, of the cost of living and people protesting against salaries that do not allow them to pay for the cost of living, that didn't go away in all that time.
So what is the assessment, Orla, of what kind of damage this has all done to Macron politically?
Well, some people in France say the fact that they used this executive order, this executive function at all, to force through the vote shows how isolated he is. The reform, it's been a centrepiece of his agenda, but I mean, some members of his own party are very unhappy with the way this has all played out. He wasn't hugely popular before all this kicked off. There was a survey yesterday showing that his popularity has fallen to its lowest since the days of the Yellow Vest protests in early 2019. I think they say around 28% of people in France now are happy with his performance. That's like down 4 points on just a few weeks ago. But the point was made to me earlier that Macron knew when he won the election last year that many people voted for him because they couldn't bear to vote for Marine Le Pen, the far-right candidate. And he himself said in his winning speech, he knew he didn't win because the majority of the public wanted him. He won because the French voters didn't want a far-right president. But in the last few days, you know, many people are saying his actions, ignoring the will of the majority of the French people, this is what will drive voters away and into the hands of the far right.
The World's Orla Barry bringing us the latest on the political turmoil in France. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu got a phone call over the weekend from President Joe Biden. The two leaders discussed Netanyahu's controversial plans to remake Israel's judicial system. It appears that Biden might have helped persuade the prime minister to backpedal on some things. Netanyahu's judicial reform plan triggered massive protests in Israel. Israelis have taken to the streets for nearly 3 months now. For more, we turn to Noga Tarnopolsky. She's an Israeli journalist and joins us from Jerusalem. What do we know about this Biden-Netanyahu phone call, Noga?
The main thing we know is that the readout from the Israeli Prime Minister's office and the readout from the White House were very different. And for me, that's an indication of a growing gulf between the two leaders. Netanyahu emphasized that they spoke about Iran and the fight against terror, and then dismissed the whole subject of the future of Israeli democracy in a quick sentence, saying he assured the president that Israel was and always will be a democracy. Whereas the White House readout really emphasized that the president spoke about shared democratic values and sort of listed them, including an independent judiciary, separation of powers, and so forth.
So after this phone call from President Biden, is there any reason for people who are opposed to Netanyahu's draconian judicial reform plan to be optimistic?
I think what has been very much commented on in Israel is that the White House has yet to invite Netanyahu, and including the phone call last night didn't include a traditional invitation, which every other Israeli prime minister has gotten, including Netanyahu in previous terms. So maybe that's a sign for opponents of his plans here that the White House is watching out for them.
So what exactly does Netanyahu's plan for the judiciary look like today?
Well, today is a crucial day because the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, is voting on some of these laws. Basically, it would give the government full control over the judiciary. And this is in a parliamentary system in which a majority coalition government already by definition has a majority in parliament.
I mean, you spoke about the growing gulf between Netanyahu and Joe Biden. Netanyahu does seem determined not to back down on this plan, but how much pressure is he facing at home and from Israel's allies abroad to change course?
He's facing, I would say, almost superhuman pressure. Israel feels like it's just coming apart at the seams. The entire defense establishment in Israel, the presidents of all the banks, the presidents of all the universities, and, as you mentioned before, hundreds of thousands of Israelis every week.
I mean, I'm just wondering, does the political opposition in Israel have any power, given Netanyahu's powerful bloc in the Knesset?
The opposition does have power, but you're right, it doesn't have a majority. I think, though, we should say Netanyahu's majority, it's sort of a just barely there majority. If a number of his own coalition members waver, he might not have a majority, and that's up in the air. For now, they've presented a really solid front.
The protests around this judicial proposal from Netanyahu have been pretty striking. I mean, people in Israel who usually don't comment about politics or protests are saying this is a bridge too far. I understand that a number of Israeli military reservists planned a walkout on Sunday. What happened with that?
They walked out. To my knowledge, for the first time in the history of the country, reservists failed to show up for duty, and they did so in a very public way. Reservists in Israel perform regular army duties all the time. So the failure to show up by a very, very elite bunch of reserve soldiers has been significant. And one of the rumors making the rounds in Jerusalem today is that the defense minister told Netanyahu he would resign from the government if a real compromise isn't made on this, you know, judicial plan.
I mean, for people, you said this is the first time that these reservists walked out. That all seems pretty surprising, or not?
I mean, it does. There's a feeling of irreality about everything that's happening in Israel right now. Not just the protests, but what has caused them. You know, when you're living here these days, every few minutes you sort of wake up and think the whole structure of government could be completely different in a matter of days. The whole way in which laws are passed, the way people go to court, even for small matters, could be completely politicized.
Noga, where do you see all this going in the coming weeks? I mean, is there a possibility Netanyahu would back down from this plan completely?
Netanyahu will only back down from this plan if he loses his majority in the Knesset, in which case he would lose power. His government would fall. So that's very hard to imagine. The way I see things right now, Israel's going very rapidly towards a massive constitutional crisis in which police officers, the military, even regular civil servants will not actually know from whom they are taking orders, because the army structure will change so much under these laws. And so we're heading right now pretty rapidly into a very, very chaotic and dangerous situation.
Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky has been covering the nationwide protests in Israel against Prime Minister Netanyahu's proposed changes to the judiciary there. She joined us from Jerusalem. Noga, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The South by Southwest Music Festival has wrapped. If you've ever been to South by, the overall impression may be one of pandemonium. Loud guitar bands and bars with the windows open, each trying to outdo the band playing at the club next door. But there is musical subtlety if you know where to look. Icelandic artists showed up at this year's South by Southwest, including two who definitely do not follow a hard-driving rock sound. Pianist Adís Evensen was classically trained. Her latest recording, The Light, nods to that background. Straddling the world of classical and pop, Evensen produced a video for the single, Anna's Theme. There's no B-roll, it's just Evensen performing in an empty church. Also from Iceland at South By, Arni Margret, who has just come out with her first album, They Only Talk About the Weather. The title track lets you in on Margaret's lyrical sense of humor, but this song, The World Is Between Us, gets at that universal feeling of being separated for too long from someone you care for.
So I hate to be here, so far away, I can't wait to see you, don't be late.
Don't be late. A reminder there that I hope you can join us tomorrow again on the show. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego, online at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong, enjoy the rest of your Monday.
But I want to see the sun.